Vineyard.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, repackaging America to win global hearts and minds in the war on terrorism. But first, the Senate approved a new anti-terrorism bill that gives police new powers. President Bush may sign it as soon as tomorrow. Betsy Palmer has been following the anti-terrorism bill for the Congressional Quarterly. She joins us from her Washington office. Good evening, Betsy.
Hello.
How will this new bill make it easier for police to track down terrorists?
Well, there's a variety of things it does, Tom. It makes it easier for law enforcement to do nationwide search warrants and seizures so that they only have to go to a judge in one district to get authority to search properties all over the country or to survey electronic communication all over the country. That certainly cuts down on their time and effort. It allows a lot more secret searches where the government can go into your house and search your property and not tell you that they've done it until significantly after the search. It allows roving wiretaps, which allow the surveillance to follow the person as opposed to being tapped to a phone. So if I were to go home, you know, they could tap it at home or at work or whatever cell phone I was using.
How does this final bill, Betsy, compare to the package that John Ashcroft originally wanted?
It's actually quite close to what Attorney General Ashcroft had requested. It's a lot closer than a lot of us thought it was going to be. He managed to get the secret searches, for example, which a lot of the House members vehemently disliked. It adds several provisions, one in particular that helps some of the immigrants who might have been hurt as a result of the World Trade Center attacks.
Meaning what?
Well, if you were an immigrant who had a husband who got killed in that attack, you might have lost your ability to apply for citizenship because you were applying by virtue of the fact that you are married to this person and then they died. Anybody who is in a situation like that has been sort of held harmless by this law. They tried to go back and say, well, you know, if the person that was helping you become a citizen has died because of the attacks, we're not going to punish you.
So it's outside the security issue, but something done specifically for those survivors.
Correct.
Betsy, the bill didn't make human rights and privacy advocates very happy. Did they have any vocal supporters in Congress today?
No, they really didn't. I shouldn't say that. Senator Russell Feingold of Wisconsin was a very outspoken opponent of this bill, but he was also the only senator to vote against it. There's been an interesting climate up here. Very few people have been willing to really go on offensive against this bill, though privately several senators have told me they were very unhappy with it.
What were the particular things that most concern civil rights advocates?
Well, the secret searches is very, you know, of great concern to them. Another provision, it's kind of complicated, but wiretaps that are done for intelligence purposes are only supposed to be done to say, oh, you know, we think that you're an agent of a foreign power. They're not supposed to be done to prosecute you as an agent of, it's not supposed to be criminal, it's supposed to be intelligence gathering. They have relaxed the standard for those kind of wiretaps, and there's a great deal of concern among civil liberties groups that the authorities will be able to use these wiretaps, go in, get the information, and then pull it out and use it to convict you in court, whereas before they would have had to go through a much higher showing of a burden of proof to get the wiretap.
And concern that it might be used not only against foreign terrorists.
Correct. Very few of these provisions are narrowly applicable to terrorists. They apply to most criminal investigations.
How does the new Secret Service secret searches policy compare to the old policy?
Well, that's an object of much discussion up here. The Justice Department maintains that it's really just codifying what they're already doing.
Meaning that they already don't have to tell you if they're searching your premises?
Well, that's what they say. They say that two circuit courts have okayed this policy and that really they're just making sure that they've got the authority to do it. Civil liberties groups, on the other hand, say, well, yeah, it was only two of the 11 circuit courts that have said it and they've not really spoken directly to it. The Supreme Court has never ruled on the constitutionality of secret searches, so it's unclear just where this stands.
Any comment today from the Attorney General or law enforcement agencies? Do they feel newly empowered by this legislation?
They do. The Attorney General is making a speech today, I think before the mayors, and he made a very strong statement saying he's going to take this law and run with it just as soon as it gets signed.
Betsy Palmer is legal affairs reporter for the Congressional Quarterly. Thank you for joining us, Betsy.
Thank you.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld says we're losing the propaganda war. That seems incredible here in the land of the brand and the home of the direct mail campaign. Washington has turned to Madison Avenue for help. Our new Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, Charlotte Beers, made her mark hawking Quaker Oats and Gillette razors. But how do you market a country loved abroad for its big ideals and loathed for its Big Macs? Joining me now is John Quelch. He's a professor of marketing at the Harvard Business School. Good evening, John Quelch.
Good evening, Tom.
Good to have you. And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Good to have you, Jack. Does America need an image adjustment? Is it time globally for the hard sell? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. John Quelch, you've paid a lot of attention to these issues in many countries for a long time. You've consulted to a lot of big corporations, and you've looked closely at how corporations and nation states interact. Here we have the president, the administration, that is, looking to a real Madison Avenue heavyweight to help buff up America's image abroad in the context of this quite serious war. Do nations need to be concerned about marketing themselves?
Yes, I do think so, Tom. And let me tell you a couple of reasons why that's the case. First of all, we have in the world today around about 200 nations, more than at any other time in recorded history. And what this means is that there's tremendous competition in the free world among these nations for example, foreign direct investment, for tourism revenues, even these days for technology knowledge workers. And so if a particular nation is going to break through the clutter, and one can almost think of it as a supermarket shelf, the breakfast cereal aisle, for instance, has almost 200 different varieties and items on it. And just in the same way, there are almost 200 nation states competing in the world economy for flows of capital, for flows of labor, and for top-of-mind awareness among these various target groups that they aim to serve.
But surely, John Quelch, the United States is in a different position. We do not have an issue of breaking through. There is quite wide awareness of the United States. Aren't the issues rather different for us?
Absolutely. If you are a small country, trying to break through the clutter is very important because you're trying to establish your top-of-mind awareness. You're almost trying to become larger than life develop a recognition that's way ahead of your share, if you like, of world population. On the other hand, if you're the United States, obviously no one does not know the United States of America. I think recognition of visual icons such as the American flag would be higher than for any other country. And so the awareness and recognition issue is not the issue. The issue is what is the image of the United States among population groups that hitherto probably the various agencies of government have not been terribly concerned to address.
So how do you see Charlotte Beers, the new undersecretary, addressing this issue? She's got unbelievable experience in the advertising world. She's, I believe, the only person to have headed up two of the major top 10 U.S. advertising corporations. Under her leadership, companies like IBM, AT&T, Microsoft, Kentucky Fried Chicken, on and on, they've all been represented. But all of that is using the levers of the global media. It's delivering a product that may be as simple as a razor blade. Now we're talking about populations that don't have access necessarily to TV, radio, even printed media that she can necessarily get into. What is Charlotte Beer's challenge?
Well, I think her first task is really to define her objectives and to define the mission of the role that she has undertaken. Is she to be the image manager of the United States worldwide? Is she to be agent who identifies and researches what the image is currently of the United States from one country to another, from one population group to another around the world? In a sense, you need that baseline research on what the current image is of the United States in order to be able to see what the problem is that you have to solve. So I hope very much that she will be looking to do some upfront research to really get a handle on what the image imagery of the United States is. I think it's quite complex because obviously there is imagery associated with the core values of the United States, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, etc. But there is also imagery that emanates from brand encounters with, you've mentioned McDonald's, you've mentioned Microsoft, you've mentioned other global brands that are known to be American. And these encounters also bear upon the overall image that any individual in the world might have of the United States. And then add to that, in the Muslim world, quite frankly, U.S. capitalism has not actively engaged with, even though the Muslim world by 2025 will represent 30% of the world's population, in that world there's a real serious gap between our ability to influence the population and what they end up thinking.
We're talking about Washington's acknowledgement that the United States has a global image problem, particularly in context of the new war on terrorism and the battle for hearts and minds, particularly in the Islamic world. What do you think? Should we be turning to Madison Avenue for a marketing campaign to present America abroad? Do we have any choice? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, we need you in here. How do you see the challenge that the United States is facing in terms of its image abroad? And what do you feel about us approaching it with a Madison Avenue touch?
Well, first of all, I'm not really inspired to read in today's Wall Street Journal that one of Charlotte Beer's first ideas was that we would use the Internet to get out our message. Al Hunt notes derisively that only 1% of the people in the Arab world are wired. So that wasn't a very good beginning, I don't think. Former Senator Nunn, has, I think, stated the importance of this whole public diplomacy activity. He says the psychological war is the key to whether our children and grandchildren will be plagued by terrorism years from now. So there's that much riding on this. And I just don't know whether a person who is expert in selling American products is really the person to sell American values. Often, of course, and people say this here, our products and our values sometimes even seem at war with each other. That is to say, we're about a lot more than Michael Jordan and Uncle Ben's Rice and McDonald's. And it sometimes just the sheer consumerism and so on it seems to be at war with democratic values like criticism and voting even. So I just think you need an injection of seriousness into this office, and I really doubt whether a person from her background is the right person. Sure, a person like that should be used, should be consulted. But this is a matter of projecting American values, projecting our story to the world, and our true story, not to do it in a crass and commercial way, but to do it, by using American culture. Mm. I began the day listening on NPR to Appalachian Spring. I'd like everybody in the Muslim world to hear that. That would do more for America than I don't know, Uncle Ben's Rice.
John Quelch, how about it? Can Madison Avenue marketing techniques be effective at delivering fundamental national values?
Tom, I think the first point to make is that the process of launching and implementing a communications campaign, the basic principles are really the same whether or not you're dealing with a brand, a commercial brand, or with a nation state. The objectives have to be very clear. There has to be a clear definition of who is being targeted by our publicity or communications efforts. We have to then figure out what message it is we want to send to those people who we are targeting. And at that point, it becomes necessary to then consider the media that we want to use in order to reach those people that we're out to reach. The point that Jack makes is very well taken, that if one's seeking to influence the entire population of the Muslim world, it's simply not going to be possible to achieve that through the Internet. On the other hand, the Internet can probably reach opinion leaders in the Muslim world, and those may be particularly useful to address initially, at least.
We're talking about the rebranding of America in the battle for global hearts and minds in the war on terrorism. You can join the conversation at 1-800- 1-800-423-TALK or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. For more information on Charlotte Beers, the country's new Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, log on to WBUR.org, click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR, Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Washington's effort to buff up the American brand abroad as it goes out to prosecute the war on terrorism. There's an awareness that our image is not what it might be and that we're not necessarily attracting the kind of support abroad that we would if it were better. Madison Avenue has been brought in to play a role, and we're looking at how effective that role might be tonight. We're joined by John Quelch, a professor of marketing at Harvard Business School, and by our news analyst, Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation as well. Call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are you comfortable having the United States of America marketed by Madison Avenue? We've already seen Madison Avenue at work in the days since September 11th, initially looking to pull the American public together. Here's a public service announcement from the Ad Council produced shortly after the 9/11 attacks. The Ad Council says the spot is designed to let the world know that diversity unites America.
I am an American. I am an American.
I am an American.
I am an American.
I am
an American.
I am an American.
I am American.
I am an American.
I'm an American.
I'm an American.
I am an American.
I am an American.
I'm an American.
I am an American.
I am an American.
John Quelch, I have to admit that, call it corny or not, that piece of Madison Avenue work made me well up. But will that kind of message and those images of the racial diversity of America play abroad that simply?
I think, again, Tom, the question is whether or not that particular aspect of America and its core values is really understood internationally by the people who we want to reach in the current climate. My guess is it's not fully understood, and in that respect, this kind of presentation can be potentially quite effective. As Jack and you have raised earlier, though, the key question is how to get this kind of message, if it is relevant, through to all of those hundreds of millions of people who apparently are receiving today messages about the United States through their news media in Muslim countries, which are largely anti-American in tone. And the propaganda war that's being talked about is, of course, the presentation of the counterbalancing point of view that we as Americans would hope would also be part of the overall communications mix that these people in these countries are receiving from their media.
Well, let's talk about that first. In countries where this global media is not as prevalent as it is in the United States and perhaps Europe and developed Asia, how does one have a hope of using Madison Avenue techniques to get down to this what we always are talking about now, the street in the Islamic world?
Right. Well, certainly the first thing that one needs to focus on is, I think, as I've already indicated, the opinion leaders in these societies. Clearly, there are, as there are in the United States or any Western democracy, a large body but a limited percentage of the population who represent the opinion leaders who are really shaping opinion on the street. And rather than thinking about how to get down to that street person directly, think of this as a two-step communication process where one's initially out to influence that 1% of the population that represents the intelligent, educated community, but which nevertheless bears has a tremendous influence on what the people on the street are thinking.
Let's look at that first. Jack Beatty, what level of confidence do you feel that those Islamic world opinion leaders are going to be are going to carry water for a Madison Avenue message from America?
Well, I guess I don't have much confidence in that, at least in the short term, from all that one reads about them. Recently, a piece about an Egyptian television talk show host who just specializes in purveying vileness about America and Israel, and he's tremendously popular. And we've learned that the governments there, these authoritarian governments, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and elsewhere, play a kind of double game. They say to their extremists, all right, don't do terrorism against us, but you can beat up on America and Israel all you want on the media. So that the governments almost have a stake in this kind of damaging to America media environment. Now, we give Egypt, $2 billion a year. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that we could start to get serious about that and with Saudi Arabia and say, look, How can we protect you when your media specializes night and day in just the vilest propaganda about America and Israel possible? You got to deliver.
Jack, it sounds like you're ready for the hard sell there.
I'm ready for the hard sell here. Yeah,
we've got callers who want to join this conversation. We're talking about the rebranding of America abroad. People have seen a lot of consumption-oriented images, but not necessarily been in touch with core American values. Now the Bush administration is trying to push those out in the context of a war. What do you think? Is Madison Avenue the way to go? Are marketing techniques the way to do it? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. Whit is on the line. Welcome, Whit.
Hi. Good evening. Good show.
Thank you.
I had a comment that actually our thought that came to me in day two or three after the tragedy on the 11th, and I wanted to run it by you all. It's more of a grassroots idea as opposed to a Madison Avenue idea, but it was to see if there are organizations or organizations could be created to allow the 7 million, I believe it is, American Muslims who there's been somewhat of a backlash against here in this country, which is obviously unfortunate, to get more involved, as it were, as ambassadors for our country and what we stand for and so forth. Particularly, would there be a program for them to get involved with some of the relief efforts in Pakistan and the refugee camps, et cetera? You got a couple million Afghanis that could perhaps be reached at a grassroots level.
Got it.
To say that, hey, you know, we like America. We're of your religion, of your faith. We'll pray with you. And
let's put that to John Quelch, and it's a very interesting suggestion. John Quelch, help us think about the, if you would, the kind of business parallels to this. Are there examples of enlisting, testimonial support from people who should be particularly qualified or trusted to comment on something, in this case, on the United States?
Well, the word trust is very important because in any brand-building exercise, what one's trying to do is create a measure of trust in the brand and what it stands for. And I think in this particular case, the Muslim communities in the United States could play a very significant role. I think at the same time, though, we've got to be just a little bit sensitive on this, because prior to the events of 9/11, there really wasn't terribly much interest, I don't think, among most Americans in what Islam, as one of the great religions of the world, actually stood for. And there wasn't really a tremendous amount of recognition of the importance, population-wise, of the Muslim populations of the world. And so all of a sudden, after 9/11, it's become, you know, rather more interesting to reach out to and use, potentially leverage the goodwill of our fellow Muslim citizens. And I think we just need to be a little bit sensitive about the eagerness with which we're now discovering them and rushing in to call on them to help us out. But certainly testimonials from individuals and groups that would have credibility with the populations around the Muslim world that we're trying to reach, influence, and speak to could be very helpful.
Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I think that we're sending the wrong message here by using the terminology Madison Avenue marketing and using someone who comes out of Madison Avenue, because I think that's what many of the population that we're talking about sort of despises about America.
So what would you do, Mike?
Well, I think one of your guests touched upon it. I think it's a diplomatic effort. I don't think we're going to reach either the opinion makers in those countries or the people on the street, as someone said, through a marketing campaign. I think it's going to take the diplomacy to talk to the leaders of those countries and maybe a media people in those countries and get our point across that way through diplomatic channels.
Mike, we've got your point, and thanks. Jack Beatty, what do you think? Surely, Charlotte Beers is not going to ultimately present herself or her product here to the world as a Madison Avenue product, but is there a way to link our diplomatic efforts and this kind of marketing effort?
I hope a way can be found. Joe Nye at the Kennedy School distinguishes between soft power and hard power. And soft power, which is essentially the totality of all our cultural influences from TV to Aaron Copland, from low culture to high culture, all of that, and hard power, of course, is military power. We want soft power to do its work, but we don't want American soft power to be strictly McDonald's. I think that's Mike's point. We want it to be about, you know, what is good about America beyond McDonald's. I just don't want to repeat myself, but we're a democracy. We have a Bill of Rights. We have freedom. These are universally appealing values. And that if you can get a Madison Avenue person who can understand the power and potential of soft power through propaganda, through media, through subtle suasions of all kind, and to have your hard power work with that so that you're not in a situation where, on the one hand, you're saying to the Muslim world, we are a caring, loving people, while on the other hand, you're dropping cluster bombs. Mm-hmm. They're the hard power and the soft power aren't working together. I mean, they can't in all cases, but we soft power is a huge force for change in the world, mm-hmm. and we've got to find a way to harness it to get our story out.
John Quelch?
I'd like to make two points. First, just take some issue with the presumption that there is a large amount of advertising and brand-building efforts that U.S. corporations have engaged in Muslim countries. In fact, because these countries have not really participated in the globalization of the world economy in the last 10 to 15 years, the degree of importance of those countries vis-a-vis companies like McDonald's, Coca-Cola, and so on in terms of the contribution they make to annual sales and profits is pretty low. There simply aren't that many McDonald's outlets in Pakistan, and I'm afraid that books such as Mr. Barber's book, McWorld versus Jihad, are really exaggerating the degree to which individuals in Muslim countries actually see lots and lots of images of American commercialism.
And yet, John Quelch, and you know this very well, you work every day on this at Harvard Business School, there are 1,000 tiny tributaries by which images flow down to populations.
Absolutely.
And there can be little doubt that image of the sort of Britney Spears and consumption is a very powerful one worldwide. And as you said earlier, opinion leaders are important, and satellite TV does reach the Middle East. I wonder, how can these kind of messages about bedrock core American values compete with the other American tidal wave of messages that go out globally? And it's not just the impoverished part of the Middle East we're talking about here, but the global images of Hollywood, of consumption, of Americans living what's often seen as a decadent or too-rich lifestyle.
Well, I think that I totally agree with the sentiment you're expressing and with Jack's earlier point. The English 19th century literary critic John Ruskin stated, I think, in very elegant terms, great nations write their autobiography in three manuscripts: the book of their deeds, the book of their words, and the book of their art. And I think Jack's point is absolutely correct, that we have not, with respect to the Muslim world, really invested significantly, for example, in student exchange programs, teacher exchange programs, journalistic exchange programs. There is a whole range of communications mechanisms that are very commonplace and that we take for granted between the United States and the rest of the developed world that cultivate a balance in our overall image that simply have not been in place vis-a-vis the Muslim world.
John Quelch, the phone lines are jammed with people who want to join this conversation on the rebranding of America. You can join. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Paul is on the line. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Good to have you.
My point, I think, is a good follow-on to what your discussion was, which is it seems to me that one of the things we need to do is make certain that our message is focused, that all of these items are items that are either done in part or maybe not done so well, but most importantly, they are not part of a focused effort. Much is made in terms of comparisons between now and the Cold War, the beginning of the Cold War, and it seems to me that at the beginning of the Cold War, at least, this may not have been true throughout, but at least in the beginning of the Cold War, we had a very focused message. It had a name in part, the Marshall Plan, perhaps some other names along the way, but our focused message had to do with the fact that we were for freedom, and for those people who were in situations throughout the world who desired freedom and their governments who desired freedom, we would go anywhere, we would make any effort to make certain that those freedoms were supported. Today, I'm not sure that message is clearly focused upon even by our government and our leaders. So
right, right.
To me, it needs to be a focused message.
We take your point, and thanks for it, Paul. Jack Beatty, what about it? Do you think that we today stand for freedom in the Middle East, and can we market our way to that image there?
I think it's a combustible ideal for us in the Middle East. On the one hand, we want to identify with the yearning, and we've heard it on this program, that people have there to have democracies, to be rid of these authoritarian regimes. On the other hand, we're also, and we have to be fearful, that when finally the lid is taken off in some of these regimes, you're going to have more Islamic fundamentalism. In other words, dissent in democracy is going to take the form of, Islamist regimes. So freedom and democracy, we need to stand for them, but I think we have to recognize their paradoxical character in that region. And perhaps the better way of talking about it is bring our ideals along, mention democracy, mention freedom, but also mention stability, trade, things that can make life better for people. And, that's what American capitalism is supposed to be all about, making life better for people. Sell that as much as anything else. That's our hope for changing China, isn't it, after all? And FDR said the best way to change the Soviet Union is to give every Soviet citizen the Sears Roebuck catalog. There's a lot to say for that.
Well, John Quilts, we don't want to assume that this new effort will be unambitious or that it will be narrow. Presumably there are many levers that can be pulled here.
Very complex, very challenging. At the same time, I just want to pick up on one point Jack mentioned relating to globalization. If you look at the average growth in GDP over the last 20 years in those countries that are in the developing world that participated in globalization through deregulation, taking down their tariffs, in some cases privatization. And if you look at those GDP growth rates and compare them against the GDP growth rates in those countries of the developing world that did not participate in globalization, many of which are Muslim countries, what you find is the GDP growth rates in the former are much higher than the latter. And therefore, part of this story has got to be selling the story of globalization and how it can create wealth.
Sounds like we may be dropping leaflets with growth charts over the Middle East. It doesn't sound like an easy challenge here, but we're taking it up. It's the rebranding of America we're talking about, how to market America and the American ideals, the American values, more effectively globally. Can those ideals compete with the noise of our consumer marketing that blankets the globe? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.
Conference in Boston, October 30th and 31st.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about an effort by Washington to rebrand America, to put a more friendly, more idealistic face on America around the world in the context of the war on terrorism. We're joined by John Quelch from the Harvard Business School and our senior news analyst, Jack Beatty. You can join as well at 1-800-423-8255. Martin is on the line. Welcome, Martin. You're on the air. Martin, are you there?
Hello?
Hello, Martin, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, we hear you loud and clear.
Oh, okay. I was just making a comment that, we're spending a lot of money on a big publicity campaign, and I really don't think
I think it's a really colossal waste of money because.
Why is that?
Well, essentially, the Germans, you know, in World War II, they went out and, you know, did a huge publicity campaign. I don't think it really changed any of the Americans' minds over here as to their issues. And in the long run, we're going to have a poor Muslim person go home and see Israeli tanks confronting Palestinians that are throwing rocks, and that's going to be their reality. It's not going to be the warm and fuzzy commercial they might see right after that on the TV.
So you raise, Martin, the issue of the limits of marketing in the face of reality. That's a great point, and thank you very much for offering it. What about it, John Quelch? I mean, every business person knows that behind the marketing, there's got to be a product that delivers. So how far can we go with marketing?
Totally agree with Martin and yourself on this. If the product is not right, then a communication effort, no matter how substantial and how well funded, is going to get us nowhere.
But we've had the sense, inside the United States at least, and maybe in the 90s, that we could market our way to almost any goal. So can we take that reality, whatever kernel of truth is there, and turn it into something that's persuasive without really working materially on the ground?
I think that it's possible, again, to look at what the information gaps are. And I come back to this earlier point, if I can just reiterate it again, that we in the United States and in the West generally have paid very little attention to engaging with and communicating at a variety of levels over many decades with Muslim countries. I would just ask your listeners to think about how many Muslim countries they visited, for example, as tourists. Tourism is a great mechanism in the global economy to fuel understanding between and across cultures. Very little cross-cultural exchange between the Muslim world and the Judeo-Christian world in terms of tourism.
But then just look at that. How many Islamic countries are open to tourism? This is a knotty issue, particularly as the caller points out, that when people start with a negative image and not much to grab onto in terms of turning it around, can be very tough. Let's take one more call. Chandra is on the line. Welcome, Chandra.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call. The point I'm trying to make is maybe it has made by several other listeners. What I'm trying to say is no matter what amount of communication or the brand building effort, it has to be sufficiently backed up by the diplomatic effort and the honest diplomatic effort, in the sense that you have to understand the local politics and then respond correctly. I mean, I can quote some examples, but
how do you think we're doing on that front, Chandra?
Well, I do not follow the whole gamut of things, but I can tell from point of view of India, wherein Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, he reiterated what Pakistan claims as that the Kashmir issue is the central for India and Pakistan, while India maintains the other way around. It says it's one of the issues between the two countries.
Chandra, we've got your point. We're running short of time. Let me give it to Jack Beattie. Jack, do you think that our diplomatic efforts so far have been sufficiently attuned to how we are perceived?
Well, it's been a fitful record. I mean, Secretary Powell was criticized for saying one thing in Pakistan and another thing in India, and having them sort of be contradictory. We're operating in a new world here, and we're trying to find our way. And I think there are going to be these hiccups. I mean, President Bush using the word crusade, for example, talk about a culturally insensitive gaffe. Mm. This is going to go on, but in the end, of course, we just have to believe that people all over the world want a better life for their families, and that part of what America is about is showing people how to do that. And that's as powerful as armies, really. And so, on the other side, are American ideals.
John Quelch, any chance that the private sector can be enlisted in this? I mean, what we hear here above all is that it's the reality behind the marketing that matters. Part of our reality is a huge private sector pumping out movies and everything else. Can they be part of this effort?
I think they can, but again, I want to make the point that if you look at the investment levels, if you look at the capital flows out of the West into the Muslim world, they are at a very, very low level relative to the population of these Muslim countries, and. Expecting the commercial for-profit sector to somehow or other engage in this kind of act, engage in this mission that we now have down in Washington, I think is asking quite a bit. It may be the case that there's a little bit more cultural sensitivity that can be shown in the advertising and the brand images that go into Muslim countries, but let's at the same time realize that understanding is a two-way street. How much understanding is the Islamic world making an effort to reach out to the West?
We're learning day by day, and it's not an easy picture. John Quelch, professor at Harvard Business School, thank you very much for joining us. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, a domestic attack on freedom. America's college campuses have long played host to heated political debates. But some college professors are now finding themselves at the center of debate as America goes to war. Our special coverage correspondent, Jonathan Saltzman, reports.
To read the documents that I've assigned to you from early America.
It's 10:30 in the morning, and John Tomasi is teaching his introductory political science class at Brown University. The clean-shaven, boyish professor hardly looks like a radical bent on corrupting impressionable young minds. He's wearing sneakers, like many of the 300 students in the lecture hall, and he banters with the class during a wide-ranging discussion that touches on the Constitution, the United Nations, and the television quiz show scandals of the 1950s. But for the past 2 weeks, Tomasi has gotten dozens of emails, including some from Brown students and alumni, accusing him of poisoning young minds with subversive views about America's war in Afghanistan. He began getting the hate mail after he let his class out 20 minutes early on October 9th so he and the students could attend a peace rally on the campus green. Tomasi says he doesn't necessarily oppose the military action against the Taliban, although he has misgivings. But he encouraged his class to see politics in action.
I said to them very clearly that I wanted them to go with me and like me to think critically. And I posed a couple of questions that I hope they would be thinking about when we went to the green. And then we carried on the conversation the next time we met on Thursday. My explicit instructions to them were, as always in the class, that our aim in there is to learn to think critically, each individual student for his or herself.
But after the student newspaper reported that Tomasi's class attended the rally, he started getting threatening emails. One called him a disgrace to America and vowed to get him fired. Another said Tomasi was lucky he didn't live in a country where he could be shot for treason. And another said, "I am writing to you to protest your corruption of our youth." Tomasi says that if he had been indoctrinating students, he would have understood the vitriol. In fact, an English professor who is a socialist did take the microphone at the rally to lambaste the American government. He got hate mail, too. But Tomasi was there simply to encourage his students to analyze thorny public policy issues.
That does mean interrogating dogmas such as patriotism, interrogating dogmas such as socialism. It means interrogating every dogma. But the crucial bit, and the crucial function, it seems to me, of a university professor and of a well-spent class time is, did you encourage people to address the issues of the day from their own unique perspectives?
On college campuses across America these days, many professors are under siege for voicing unpopular views about the war. Some, like Tomasi, have drawn criticism merely for urging students to weigh the pros and cons of America's response to the September 11th terrorist attacks. Others are under fire for saying America shares blame for the terrorist attacks or has committed terrorism of its own. While Brown University administrators defended Tomasi's actions, officials at other colleges have pilloried professors for unpopular views. At the University of Texas at Austin, for example, Robert Jensen, a journalism professor, caught flack for an opinion piece he wrote for the Houston Chronicle. Jensen wrote that the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon were despicable, but no more despicable than what he called massive acts of terrorism by America over the past 50 years. He says the United States deliberately killed innocent civilians in Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Central America, Iraq, and other countries. After Jensen's piece appeared in the newspaper, a conservative radio talk show host in Houston attacked him and urged people to call the university to get him fired. Jensen has tenure, so that almost certainly won't happen. But the university's president, Larry Faulkner, wrote a letter to the Chronicle castigating the professor. He wrote that Jensen has a constitutional right to speak his mind. But, he said, he was disgusted by Jensen's article and called him a fountain of undiluted foolishness. Professor Jensen says he's undeterred.
It's had no effect on me. I just continue to go forward and do the writing and speaking and activism that I do. And I think the bigger question is whether his attack on me had a chilling effect on others on campus. And my sense is it probably did with some people, which means he committed an offense not against me personally, but against the intellectual community at UT.
In another incident, a trustee at the City University of New York called remarks by professors and students at an anti-war teach-in at City College seditious. And a government professor at Orange Coast College in Costa Mesa, California, was placed on paid leave after he argued with Muslim students in class and allegedly called them terrorists and murderers. Few people condone name-calling and personal attacks in the classroom. Nonetheless, many education experts say they're troubled by what seems to be widespread intolerance of unpopular views about the war on college campuses, particularly positions against the war. Stanley Kurtz is a fellow at the Conservative Hudson Institute and one-time lecturer at Harvard University and the University of Chicago.
Sharp criticism of people from all points of view is completely legitimate, but we've really seen things that have gone beyond them. We've seen people giving out the personal phone numbers and email addresses of professors, and then these people being flooded with hate mail, some of them even with emails with threatening headings like "Dead Man Walking." That kind of terrorization is completely illegitimate.
But Kurtz says left-wing professors have only themselves to blame for much of the abuse. In the current issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education, he writes that liberal professors over the past 20 years have taken over many college campuses and stifled anyone with conservative, politically incorrect views. Now they're getting a taste of their own medicine as they find themselves muzzled or shouted down for voicing unpopular opinions.
And so what's happening is that the erosion of our tradition of campus free speech and the absence of people of conservative views on college campuses has created an atmosphere that is likely to leave the leftist professorate under siege in a case where Americans are in strong disagreement with them and where they feel they have the right to speak.
But Mary Burgan, the head of the American Association of University Professors, says college campuses still have plenty of conservative professors and that most instructors hold mainstream views. She says professors are under attack because many Americans still accuse them of undermining the United States in the Vietnam War, which Burgan calls a myth. Now, she says, supporters of the United States war on terrorism are worried that professors will somehow undercut America again. Burgan also says professors are under siege because Americans traditionally have a deep-seated distrust of intellectuals.
I think our country really is a country of doers. And I think there is a notion that real Americans get out and do and don't waste too much time on thought. So professors are likely to be thought of as sometimes amiable, sometimes threatening, ivory tower creatures who never do anything. And that, I think, of course, is a stereotype. It seems to me that our administration is spending a lot of time in debate and trying to understand the sources of antagonism against our country. We've got to understand. And I don't see why faculty trying to understand and trying to talk together, especially with students, seems so threatening.
At Brown University, Darren Ranahan, one of Professor Tomasi's students, says he's glad he went to the anti-war rally. He took his professor's advice. He scrutinized the anti-war rhetoric and found it wanting.
They called the war racist and just made general attacks, but they failed to provide other solutions for us what we could do.
Ranahan, a 17-year-old freshman, says it was a valuable lesson. I'm Jonathan Saltzman.
For extensive coverage of the war on terrorism, log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR, Boston.